During Ramadan, we study the Quran from beginning to end. That quiet reflection, particularly when you have started your fast early at the crack of dawn, it's quiet. It's almost dark, but not quiet. There are no sounds around you. In that quiet moment of reflection, there is joy, a quiet joy.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. Have you ever met someone who saw a problem and decided they wanted to fix it? And then these opportunities started popping up and suddenly your friend is traveling the country and helping other people? That's the kind of person our guest is today. Someone who sees a challenge and jumps right in to make sure she can help. And it's led to speaking engagements and writing and outreach to influence the attitudes Americans have about Muslims. Sabiha Rahman, an author, podcaster, blogger, playwright, and speaker on the American Muslim experience, is best known for her award-winning book, Threading My Prayer Rug, One Woman's Journey from Pakistani Muslim to American Muslim. She's an op-ed contributor to The Wall Street Journal and also co-founded the National Autism Association New York Metro Chapter, serving as its president from 2008 to 2011. I wonder if you'd tell me how you felt as a person of faith arriving here in the States.
I felt anonymous and I felt lonely, in the sense that no one around me, whether it was my neighbors or people in the neighboring communities, knew where I came from. They would ask me, and I would say Pakistan, and they would say, where is that? It did not matter to them what my faith was, which was good in some ways, but on the other hand, I wanted them to be aware of my identity as a Muslim. And generally speaking, in the media, the image of the Muslims was being portrayed in a negative manner, associated with violence, and that was very disturbing and isolating. This was 1971 when I came. Since there were no Muslim communities at that time, it was a lonely place.
You really had to build your own infrastructure as a community.
Yes, it became a matter of survival and that of our children's future. There was a need for us to establish not only an institution of learning for them, but also build a community of Muslims so that they could be confident in their faith. And to do that, we had to start from scratch. We would go through the yellow pages looking for Muslim-sounding names ending in an Ahmad or a Muhammad or a Khan, and then picking up the phone and calling them and saying, you know, we are Muslims, we live in Staten Island, we'd like to get to know you. And they knew a few more, who knew a few more. And that's literally how we got started. And we started meeting in living rooms. And then as we grew, we started meeting in basements. And we would start off by just being together. And eventually, we felt that, okay, now we had a critical mass where we could establish a Sunday school for our children. They needed to be amongst their peers and feel confident. Because prior to that, I was just teaching my children on my own, and I was pretty ignorant in the faith.
You bring up a really interesting point. You said, I was ignorant of my faith. But I wonder if you'd share with us briefly just how you were raised, and would you talk to me about your early beginnings in the faith?
I grew up as a secular Muslim. My father was in the military, and it was my grandparents who gave me my religious instruction. I grew up very devout in my faith. My connection to God was deep and profound, thanks to the values that my grandparents and my parents also inculcated. I practice praying, saying the prayers. I practice fasting. But that's where it ended. I did read the Quran in Arabic. The cleric would come to the house and teach me how to read the Quran. And I read it from beginning to end. And when I completed the recital of the Quran in Arabic, my religious education was considered complete. The fact that I didn't understand a word of what I was reading was considered inconsequential. So I grew up strong in faith and totally ignorant in the theology. And the reason for that was everybody around me was a Muslim. There were no challenges. Nobody was asking questions. Nobody was challenging the faith. So there was no need to know more than I already did, which was nothing. So it was only when I came to the United States and had to raise my children in the faith, and my children were asking questions that I never asked, like, Mom, why 5 times a day prayer? Why not 6? Why not 4? That I realized that if I have to educate them, I have to be educated. And I started going to the book, and my husband started going to the scripture, and so did other moms and dads in our situation. And we started learning about the theology. And it opened doors, it opened windows, it opened hearts, it opened minds.
I love that it's children that pushed you into that, because they don't come with preconceived notions. And one of the delights, usually a delight, of children is that they see things in a way that lets us see them in ways maybe we've forgotten.
Children are our best teachers.
Amen. You describe growth just now, but you also describe in your book moments of doubt. And I think faith and doubt are maybe two necessary sides of the same coin. What was that experience like for you?
Okay, so I never, ever doubted the existence of God, mm-hmm. or that He was omnipresent, and that He was my guardian, and that He would guide me, and whatever the outcome is, it will be in my best interests, even if I don't see it that way. What I started doubting and questioning were the practices. Because once I started studying the Quran, I learned that a lot of practices and traditions in Pakistan were not compatible with God's ordinances in the Quran. So, for example, there is a practice in Pakistan called iddat. When a woman is widowed, she is confined to the home for 4 months. She is not to be in the company of a male adult unless it's a member of the family. And, you know, I never questioned it. When I studied the Quran, God is instructing us that a widow can remarry, but she must wait for 4 months and 10 days before she marries, period. Nothing about confinement.
No isolation.
No isolation. Mm-hmm. So I started questioning that, because when I rationalized this ordinance, the waiting period, I concluded, and many others agreed with me on that, that was to establish paternity. In the event that the widow is found to be pregnant, one should know who the father of the child is, because lineage is a very important component of Sharia. And by 4 months, you would know. So wait. Because if she marries before that and she's learned to be pregnant, who is the father? That comes under question. So that's, you know, like just one example. And in that process, it strengthened my relationship with God, because what God is saying makes so much more sense than how many of us practice the faith.
Well, you really point out that we all should look at our beliefs and our traditions and sift out what is the teaching of God and what is the cultural supports that were intended, good intentions, but may have overstepped their bounds. You begin your book as a Pakistani Muslim in America, and you end with speaking of yourself as an American Muslim. What is different?
When we first opened the doors of our mosque, we noticed that people from all ethnicities and countries of origin were congregating there. You had the Arabs, the Africans, South Asians, Europeans, Turkish. Everybody was practicing the rituals differently. And each thought that my way is the right way and you don't know what you're doing. And that's when we realized that so much of what we practice was a consequence of culture and tradition, which we erroneously attributed to the faith, because we were all Muslims, so it must be the Muslim way. And that gave us pause, which was that our children are growing up in an American culture. So how are they going to express Islam? And to do that, we had to go back to the scripture, study it, separate the theology from the culture, take the theology and wrap it in the colors of red, white, and blue. Our children did that organically, but we had to do that deliberately and consciously. And what we saw was the evolution of an American Muslim identity, not only for us, but mostly for our children. And by that, I mean that some things changed and some things did not. The core values did not change. The belief in God, the belief in the angels, the day of judgment, belief in all the prophets that preceded Prophet Muhammad, belief in the books that were revealed to the prophets that preceded Prophet Muhammad, all of that does not change. But what changed is how you express yourself. So you are expressing something that is wholly Islamic and wholly American. So let me give you an example. When I was in Pakistan and I got married, I changed my name from Sabiha Akbar to Sabiha Rahman. When I came to the United States and I studied the Quran, it said, call the child by the father's name because the lineage is important. Now, my name changed not because it was the Islamic way, but because it was the British way. The British had colonized Pakistan for 200 years. This is a practice that they brought with them. And over the centuries, it became associated with Islam because we were all Muslims. Now, American Muslim women are keeping their maiden name because they have studied the Quran. They are educated in the theology and they are saying, I'm not giving up my maiden name. That is what God has ordained. So that's just one example. The other is that of interfaith marriages. Interfaith marriages are and will continue to take place, and that is entirely Islamic because in the Quran, God has said that we can marry people of the book. So women and men are doing that. What has also changed is the role of women in the mosque. In the old country, women did not go to the mosque. It was a man's thing. That's just the culture. Here, they are leading. They are on the board. Some of them are the presidents. Some of them are leading the largest Muslim organizations like the Islamic Society of North America, had Ingrid Mattson for a number of terms as their president. They are setting the curriculum, they are teaching, they are fundraising. Yes, they are also managing the kitchen, but they are at the table. And that is a huge shift from the practices in the old country, but it is so Islamic because it is an extension of motherhood. Also, the imams in our mosque has changed. When we first opened the doors of our mosque, there were no spiritual leaders, so we had to import them from the old country. They didn't speak the language, they didn't know the culture, and our children could not relate to them. Now we have seminaries where American-born men and women are being educated to lead in a spiritual space. And that's a huge shift. And then there are many more examples of an American expression of Islam. For example, in the old country, if we had to give thanks, we would cook a dessert and go into the neighborhood distributing single-size servings to the neighbors saying that we are celebrating and we're giving thanks. Now we have Thanksgiving. We have Mother's Day. We have Father's Day. All very Islamic and all very American.
This is In Good Faith. We're speaking with Sabiha Rahman, American Muslim. In Good Faith is proud to host a diversity of voices. We don't simply interview one Muslim and say, well, now we know what Muslims think. We talk to Muslims, as well as Jews, Buddhists, Christians, and others from all kinds of places and backgrounds, so we can hear a multiplicity of voices, attitudes, and practices from the religious people around us. Find all of our episodes on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube, and share an episode that's meant something to you with the people in your life. Hi, this is Stephen Cap Perry, and I'd love to recommend one of our BYU Radio family of podcasts for you. It's called The Appleseed. It's filled with stories for you and your family. Every episode features really excellent, nationally known storytellers sharing all kinds of folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family stories. It's great to put on and listen to for road trips or bedtime for kids or anytime you want something to get the whole family not only listening, but then those stories generate conversations. And it's so easy to say, hey, do you have a story about this? Or, oh, that reminds me of when grandma said, or whatever it might be. Check out the Appleseed podcast. You'll have fun and you might learn some new stories from your own family members. More from Sabiha Rahman. You've written a lot about misconceptions of Islam, very poignantly, especially during the time of 9/11. What have been the most common misconceptions that you've encountered? And have you seen change in understanding over the decades?
So two misconceptions. Number one, Islam oppresses women. Number two, Islam is a violent faith. We responded, and when I say we, I mean me, my husband, and people like us who were engaged in interfaith dialogue, was number one, not to get defensive. Rather, raise awareness. And not through an academic lecture on the facts and the figures, but by telling our own stories, by making ourselves known, by putting a face to the faith. And yes, a lecture by a scholar on a podium in a public place has value, but it only goes so far. What takes you further is when you develop intimate relationships, when you meet in small meetings, in your living room, around your kitchen table, you huddle in small spaces, you get personal, you get intimate. That's when your conduct and your example starts demystifying these myths and these misconceptions. And the next thing I knew years later was that people that I knew would be going around saying, no, Islam doesn't oppress women. I know a Muslim woman. She's an author. Another said, I know a Muslim woman. She's a CEO of a nonprofit organization. She runs a podcast. She's running for office. Doesn't seem oppressed to me. So just by personal example, and you know, when my girlfriends would visit in my home, they would see my husband making coffee, serving them coffee, and this looked like, that doesn't look like, you know, an oppressive, oppressive male.
They were wishing he could teach their husbands.
Yeah, maybe. And then, you know, when they see us engaged in community projects. So right here in New York, we have the Muslim Volunteers for New York who are cleaning the parks as a family initiative, you know, planting bulbs, raking the leaves. When we speak out against violence, as an example, when the Tree of Life massacre took place, Muslim organizations did fundraising, went to show up for Shabbat.
That was a synagogue that was attacked, a Jewish synagogue.
Yes, a Jewish synagogue. And, you know, people showed up, Muslims showed up for Shabbat at the synagogues to mourn together. We also educate. My husband and I give Islam 101 lectures. We do talk about what the text says because that gives it credibility. But we also highlight the fact that it's bad news that makes headlines and casts us in an image of being violent. We use social media to amplify the voices of moderation. My husband would write for the Staten Island Advance, the local paper of Staten Island, every month on Islam. So through his writings, he was educating readers. And then we are engaged in interfaith groups. For example, there's the Sisterhood of Salaam Shalom, where Muslim and Jewish women come together to overcome bigotry and make peace. There's the Daughters of Abraham that I'm involved in. We have interfaith book clubs. We have a Make a Muslim Friend project. So all of that has helped us reshape the opinions of those who we come into contact with. And the reason why I wrote the book was to reach to those whom we do not come into contact with personally. Mm. And it happened when our grandson, Umar, was detained at the airport. He was 8 years old. They were getting on a plane to go to Disney World, and he was pulled aside by the authorities. This was 2010, because his name was the same as a terrorist on the no-fly list. Mm. I got a call from my daughter-in-law saying, we are in detention. Then she writes to me and says, he's hungry, he is stimming, and our grandson is autistic, and the authorities would not let the family go out to get him some food. And they kept saying, we know it's not him, but we have our process and we have to go through that. I'm on the phone calling the press, I'm calling my elected officials, I'm in New York, they're in Pennsylvania. Nothing worked, and it was then that my husband said to me, I've been urging you for many years now to write a book, because it's not enough that we are speaking to those people who are in our closed communities on the East Coast. We are preaching to the choir. You need to reach people in the middle of the country, the coast on the west, the mountains on the north, the desert on the south, places we cannot reach. So that's when I wrote this book.
I'm just imagining, as a grandfather, that feeling of helplessness and the mistreatment of your child or a grandchild, that's just so visceral.
Yeah, that really struck a nerve. Some may challenge me by saying, well, you know, America liberated you. You have achieved what you have, and many Muslim women have gotten what as far as they have because America provided that opportunity. It is then that I relate the stories of the Pakistani history where Benazir Bhutto was twice elected as the Prime Minister of Pakistan. We are still not there. That there are women who are in the armed forces. There are fighter jet pilots. My sister is a attorney at the Supreme Court in Pakistan. And then Shermin Obaid, a filmmaker, twice winner of an Academy Award for her documentaries. I use those examples to highlight that, yes, America has offered me a lot of opportunities, but so has my faith.
From your vantage point now, as you look back, do you feel like God put you in certain places, put people in your path to make a difference? Can you tell that? Do you feel that?
I do feel that. I do feel God says in the Quran, you take one step towards me, and I will take 10 steps towards you. And so I believe that the people who have been placed in my path, the doors that people have opened for me, the path that was paved for me, people pushing me, people pulling me, is part of God's grand plan. I have to believe that because that's my faith. That's my faith, that you ask God for guidance and he will guide you. And then you have to place your trust in him and accept the consequences, like it or not, because that's God's grand plan.
I think one thing that could possibly have tested your faith was as you decide you're raising your children here as Muslims, but how will that be different because of the country and the culture you're in rather than where you had been raised? You had interesting choices to make, like what do we allow? What are the hard lines we don't cross? Or so many decisions. Will you talk to me about raising Muslim children in the U.S.?
The hardest part was sending my boys away to college. I was afraid that the boundaries that we have set may get blurred, that without our 24/7 helicoptering presence, that they might fall into temptation, peer pressure, you have it.
Some of that every parent feels sending them off.
Yeah, right, right. You know, the heart and soul of a Muslim mother is like that of any other. So I'll just give you an example that because sex outside marriage is prohibited in Islam, actually in all faiths, there are boundaries that we place on the extent to which the opposite sex will mingle so that one thing doesn't lead to the other. And those boundaries change from culture to culture, tradition to tradition. So this is what my son announces to me. He's planning his dormitory assignments and he tells me he is selecting a co-ed dormitory.
Okay.
And my flags went up and I said, why don't you go to an all-male dormitory? And he said, two reasons, Mom. Number one, the boys are noisy, they are rowdy, they drink all night, and I need quiet time to study. Okay. What's the second reason? He said, the girls' dormitories are much cleaner. He said, okay. I can't argue with that. So I said, all right, God, we have raised him with the values that we felt were best for them, and now I have to let go. They're on their own, and please watch over them.
Mm. The very title of your book has this beautiful image, to thread your prayer rug. Talk to me about that image, if you would, and what it means to you.
It's a metaphor for my shifting identity as a Muslim and an American, moving from being a Pakistani Muslim to an American Muslim. My prayer rug is a constant. It is a symbol of my devotion to God. I take that out every day, 5 times a day, spread it on the floor, facing Mecca, northeast, and I offer my prayers. What has changed is its look. It's no longer in the colors of gold and green. Now I have been threading it in the colors of red, white, and blue. So I'm now expressing Islam in an American context. according to my new and evolving understanding of the faith. So it's more than me just changing the direction of my prayer rug. The look of my prayer rug has changed. And it will continue to change as I continue to evolve as a Muslim, even at this age. So I am not done with threading my prayer rug.
Whether people who read your book are Muslim or not, is there some kernel you hope they walk away with? Something that sticks with them?
I do. I hope that they walk away feeling that the heart and soul of a Muslim mother is like that of any other. That Islam does not advocate violence. Misguided people do. That Islam does not oppress women. Misguided people do. That we have the same dreams for our children. We have the same worries. We have the same fears. We have the same drive. And that we are not a monolith. The hijab and beard does not define us. The race, color, country of origin, ethnicity does not define us. And that our values are entirely compatible with the American values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I wrote this because I don't want my grandchildren to be afraid to say, I am a Muslim. And I want the reader to say, Muslims are people just like us.
I think you've hinted at this, but I wonder if I could just ask you, what in your faith brings you joy?
You know, the practice of fasting during Ramadan brings me joy. I look forward to it. I literally go through a countdown. That's, when is Ramadan starting? And, you know, you would say, why would I look forward to not eating? But it's the feeling, the deeply spiritual experience that you have during Ramadan that I look forward to. And God says in the Quran that I have ordained this for you so that you achieve God consciousness. And I feel that. When I walk by the kitchen and extend my hand to the cookie jar, I am reminded that God has said, not right now. Wait until sundown. So it's those moments that continuously remind me of God. I'm feeling thirsty. No, God said, wait until sundown. Someone says, have you heard? And no, God has said no gossip during Ramadan. Well, no gossip, period, but particularly you become God conscious and you stop, you know, engaging in, in conversations that are not beneficial to anybody. Somebody says something that gets me angry. God said, control your anger. You are fasting. Exercise restraint. So that gives me a certain kind of joy, not in, yeah, but more in,
something quiet and inner.
Yes. Also, during Ramadan, just as a ritual, we study the Quran from beginning to end. And that quiet reflection, particularly when you have started your fast early at the crack of dawn, it's quiet. It's almost dark, but not quite. There are no sounds around you. In that quiet moment of reflection, there is joy, a quiet joy.
Many thanks to Sabiha Rahman for speaking with me. This episode was produced by Heidi Clough. Our production team also includes Heather Bigley, Heidi Clough, Nick Levitt, and Ocean Marshall. Our post-production sound designers are James Call, DJ Cromarty, and Gabriel Haro. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. You can check out more of our episodes and extended interviews on our YouTube channel. Connect with us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith.